Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Thomas Nettle, attorney registration number 35011, and I'm here on behalf of CNC Excavating and Earth Contractors. And to begin with, I'd like to clarify that in this case, on the primary issue that we're discussing today, the standard of review is de novo review. This is a purely legal question of which side bears the burden of proof as to an issue. Obviously, the Lawson case is one that has the potential to confuse matters here. I would submit that Lawson is not dispositive in this matter. The case, as an initial matter, is not a model of clarity, but the issue of which party bears the burden of addressing collectability in a legal malpractice case was not decided by the Supreme Court in Lawson. Instead, the Supreme Court says we don't need to reach that issue because even if the burden is on the defendant, the plaintiff's case in chief proved that any judgment would be uncollectible.
In addition, counsel, that case didn't talk about collectability. It talked about the insolvency of the debtor in the underlying action. And here there's no dispute, is there, regarding the insolvency of the debtors in the underlying action?
That's correct. But there is a larger issue that deals with the equity of the properties and the value of any judgments that were attached to those mechanics liens.
And Lawson didn't address those issues.
Correct. Lawson did not address any of those issues. But I think it's helpful to start with the general proposition that this is a legal malpractice case, and so there's the case within a case component, which imposes on the plaintiff the burden of proving duty, breach, causation, and damages. But the issue of what those damages are is a little bit less clear.
Counsel, excuse me for interrupting again. I'm sorry, but I just wanted to follow up on your comment, your that point you made. I think the third element is establishing injury that was proximately caused by the conduct, the negligent conduct of the defendant, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
So it's not just amount of damages, it's also the fact of damages and the causation, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
And what that actually leads into the point that I was just about to make, which is to prove damages in a malpractice case or any other case in Colorado, plaintiff doesn't have the burden of proving the precise amount of damages. The plaintiff has the burden of proving the fact that some injury occurred and providing a means by which a fact finder can put a value on those damages. And I would submit to this court that in a malpractice case, the best evidence of the value of the underlying claim is the judgment that was obtained in the underlying claim. Because that's an amount that's been settled by a fact finder after a hearing in which the plaintiff is required to produce evidence of injury as to the underlying claim and provide a value on it. And at that point, the fact finder evaluates that evidence and sets a number.
Does that apply here, though? Because the issue is not what the amount of the judgment is. The issue is exclusively whether there's any monies that can be recovered from the collateral, or here the lien that should have been placed on the land. And therefore, we don't have any evidence that there was any value to that lien, do we?
Well, we don't. And that's what leads into the issue of collectability and whether that should be treated as an affirmative defense or a core element of the case. But I think it is important to note that even in a case like this, where the properties in question might have insufficient equity to satisfy a judgment, that does not make the judgment worthless. As there was testimony in this case by Brad Sheffrin, in a mechanics lien case, even where there's negative equity situation, after a developer and others have pooled capital to develop a piece of real estate, they will often pay off a judgment lien, even where the equity in the property is insufficient, so that that project can reach its conclusion and that they can all benefit from the development that they've invested their funds in.
In this, did Sheffrin testify to that?
I believe Sheffrin testified that specifically, liens will often be settled by other parties so that that the development can continue to avoid a foreclosure.
Okay.
So I'm extrapolating a little bit off of what he said, but a judgment has a value, and that value is, and I'm speaking broadly about legal malpractice claims, judgment has a value that extends long beyond the statute of limitations on a legal malpractice, or on a legal malpractice claim. You've got a two-year claim for a negligence claim, two-year window, But a judgment is good for 20 years, and then can be extended for successive 20-year periods, which means that that judgment, while not collectible on the day that it enters or would have entered, may be collectible in the future. A rule that puts the burden on the plaintiff to prove that someday down the line that judgment would be collected sets up an unfair burden on the plaintiff that should properly be borne by the defendant.
But the majority view is exactly the opposite of what you're arguing, isn't it?
That is correct, although the majority view also is a view that's taken in states that lack Colorado's unique language in Rule 8C that says any facts in the nature of mitigation must be affirmatively pled, any fact that lowers the amount of damages. And so in this case, what we have is we have evidence of judgments against the Cottonwood Meadows property, the Sundown Terraces, the Bear Creek Terraces, and the Indian Hills developments. We have evidence of what those judgments either were or should have been absent negligence. And then we have an argument that plaintiff would not have been able to collect on that. So we have a cap, and then we have argument that, well, it wouldn't have been that because there would have been some form of difficulty with collecting. That's something that would serve to reduce the damages. And under Rule 8C's language, that would be something in the nature of a confession and avoidance, and that's a burden that should be on the defendant.
The judgments that were obtained were not collectible, right? There were judgments obtained, but they weren't collectible.
Well, actually, there was no testimony. Well, let me step back. There were judgments obtained, and in this case, they were uncollectible because the liens were unenforceable. Had those liens been valid, then any number of factors might have gone forward to result in a settlement of the lien claims or cause them to be collectible. But without a valid lien, they become uncollectible.
Is there anything in the record that would indicate that anybody was interested in paying any money to settle such a claim?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
I mean the problem I keep coming back to is the plaintiff's burden of proving that proximate cause for the injury that the plaintiff claims it suffered. And it seems to me the only injury that the plaintiff can claim they suffered is failure to receive monies on their judgment because the liens weren't perfected. And therefore, here, it may very well be, and all we can do is speculate either way, obviously, but it may very well be that the liens that they could never have been enforced and that nobody would have ever necessarily paid them any money in settlement. So what you're asking is, and let me see if this is correct, you're asking us to create a presumption, which I think there's no case law supporting it in Colorado, but a presumption under this situation that the plaintiff has value merely because counsel went out and got the judgments, and that therefore there's a value that we presume the mechanics lien would have had. Is that right?
Not entirely. And the point of dispute here is not that what I'm asking is that you presume that a judgment has some value, because I think that that is the point that I'm arguing. But there is authority for this point, that a judgment has some value. There's the Nunn v. Mid-Century case, which says that a stipulated judgment entered before trial in an insurance bad faith case is evidence of damages. There's also a case, it's Hershey v. Johnson, 91 Colo 113. It's a 1932 case that involved a claim of negligent escape. So the sheriff in this case had taken a debtor into custody under a body execution, and then allowed the debtor to escape from custody. And what the Supreme Court held in that case is that in the trial on the negligent escape claim, that the judgment debtor had against him was the presumptive measure of damages. However, that the judgment creditor at trial, or sorry, that the sheriff at trial, could argue that the judgment debtor was insolvent or lacked sufficient funds to satisfy that judgment as an affirmative defense.
And is this cited in either of your briefs?
I'm afraid it isn't cited in the briefs. I only learned of the case the other night. But Nunn v. Mid-Century is cited in our briefs, and it does address this issue. And further, I direct the court to the Jordanian case, which is the main Supreme Court case on the question of collectability as an affirmative defense. And in that case, the Supreme Court there held that the fact that a judgment would not be collectible is, in its words, in the nature of confession and avoidance.
That's a Maine case. When you say Supreme Court, you mean the Supreme Court of Maine.
Correct. But, again, Rule 8C does require that any matter in the nature of confession and avoidance be pled and proved as an affirmative defense.
I think the cases and the situations that you cite in your brief all involved mitigating circumstances where the defendant went out and did something, like publishing a retraction to allegedly libelous article. Here, there's no allegation that the defendant is not arguing that he did something to mitigate the damages. He's saying you didn't prove your damages.
Well,
you didn't prove injury.
2 points. First of all, the main case explicitly held that collectability is in the nature of confession and avoidance, which is a common law defense that says basically, yes, the facts that you state are true. I was negligent. You lost a judgment. But although I made these errors, you would not have recovered what you claim you would have recovered. And so the damages are lesser. And that's essentially what is occurring here. But also, the Mossman case, which is a libel case that we cite in our brief, in that case, the defendant newspaper alleged that, well, it's true that the facts were untrue that it had published in its newspaper article. It was reporting on then-current rumors of the defendant's conduct, or of the plaintiff's conduct, and that therefore, this was evidence that showed that his reputation was not as good as he claimed it was, and so his damages were lower. So this isn't a situation, in that case, where they'd done a retraction or anything. What it was a situation where they pled and proved that there were rumors about the plaintiff having abused his wife, failed to heat his home, and separating his wife from their infant child. And because those rumors were circulating, those damages were lower.
So in other words, there was proof of actual injury.
Yes, Your Honor. But
and then you're saying that, and then it was mitigated after that.
But I would submit, again, that a judgment, even standing alone, has value. The other,
25 cases cited, and I think in these briefs, some that say this is the rule, some. Are any of those cases involving malpractice in connection with a lien foreclosure action that would be a parallel to what we have here? Because it just seems so unique.
I cannot answer that question for certain. I can't recall. I think there might be one, but it's not coming to my mind at the moment. I would like to take just a brief moment to address some of the issues raised in the
Council. You have about 2 minutes and 20 seconds left. Yeah.
As an initial matter, there was evidence at trial that plaintiff had paid Mr. Whaley in the area of $49,000, and that roughly 75% to 85% of that represented payments related to these claims. That's evidence on which the judge based his conclusion that $35,000 in damages was proper. And so that evidence then supports the judgment. And so Mr. Whaley's claim that we were not the prevailing party in the underlying action would be incorrect. Likewise, there was evidence that the trial court entered its award of fees on the discovery dispute based on the defendant's failure to provide updated interrogatory responses and to provide updated responses to requests for admission. That evidence supports the trial court's exercise of discretion in awarding fees and costs. And at that point, I'd like to reserve what's left of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel. So for appellee.
Richard Farley, 17134. I'm the defendant as an individual and as my PC in this matter. The first thing I'd like to address is the hypothetical situation about possible some settlement value, even though the liens were not properly perfected. And counsel referred to some statements of Brad Sheffrin with regard to that issue. Brad Sheffrin was endorsed solely on the issue of malpractice and negligence. He was not endorsed at all with regard to damages.
Did you object to his testimony on damages?
Yes, I did object, and that objection was sustained. And The proof that it was sustained is in a sentence on page 14 of the court's order, that what says any settlement value of this case could have been established by a duly qualified expert who could have opined on whether the lien foreclosure actions had settlement value, irrespective of the underlying debtor's insolvency. So the trial court right there is pointing out that they didn't endorse anybody on the issue of the damages with regard to the mechanics lien. The only expert they had was Schifrin, and he was endorsed solely for the purpose of the negligence and the malpractice issue. And as I indicated, it was objected, and the objection was sustained.
Saying this, he sustained the objection in the order, is that what you're saying?
Pardon?
You're saying he sustained the objection in the order? Or at or during
in the trial.
At the trial.
At trial, yes, not in order. I'm just saying that that sentence in the order seemed to support what the court said in sustaining the trial. And what really here is the underlying issue in this, the case within a case, is what would the plaintiffs have recovered, if anything, had the mechanics lien proceeded properly and proceeded successfully. And as pointed out by the order of the trial court numerous times, that there was no evidence submitted whatsoever on the issue of what would have happened had the mechanics lien proceeded to a successful conclusion. Successful not meaning that there were damages at the end of it, but successful as to would there have been anything left for these plaintiffs. As was very reluctantly agreed to in the transcript by Mr. Schifrin, that he himself agreed that there was no such evidence. Mr. Schifrin, he made a statement on the last page of his opinion, and that statement was to the effect that, but for my negligence, that the plaintiffs would, in the mechanics lien, have recovered the full amount of the claim in their liens. And in going through the mechanics lien foreclosure process with Mr. Schifrin, he reluctantly agreed that that is not necessarily true. And in this case, there was no evidence of it whatsoever. Mr. Schifrin first addressed on the issue of the priority of the liens. And Mr. Schifrin, as the transcript points out, incorrectly said that it was so a kind of a race to the courthouse for priority, and that's quite contrary to the mechanics lien statute, and that was pointed out to Mr. Schifrin. And it was also pointed out that the first thing you have to do to determine what, if anything, a lien claimant is going to get is there any equity in the property being foreclosed upon?
Counsel, really, the issue that we're trying to determine is whose burden it is to prove the collectability, right? I mean, a minority of jurisdictions have shifted the burden to the defendant attorney to prove that any judgment in the underlying case would not have been collectible. I think I read in your counterpart's brief that that's the modern trend. Would you agree that that's the modern trend? This minority jurisdiction view of shifting the burden to the defendant attorney, would you agree that that's the modern trend among the courts?
Not.
Okay. Regardless, let me try to share my concern with you and ask you to address it. Given the defendant attorney's negligence, isn't it more fair to put the burden on the defendant attorney to prove non-collectability than on the plaintiff to prove collectability as part of the plaintiff's case in chief?
No. Whether it's fair or not, I think the issue of collectability as to a judgment which all these cases cited on, is different than what you're going to have in a mechanics lien foreclosure.
How so?
And this is not a collectability issue, because the judgments were obtained by me. There was no dispute but what the parties were insolvent. And as the case point out, if it is insolvent and there was no dispute in this place, then the claim of the plaintiff is dismissed.
So why isn't it fair to put the burden on you to prove the insolvency, the non-collectability, instead of to put the burden on the plaintiff in these cases?
Well, there was no dispute with regard to the insolvency as to the judgments. The right. issue would have to be only with regard to any value in the property.
Right, the collectability. And what I'm asking, and I think what the case turns on, is why wouldn't it be fair to put the burden of proof on you, the defendant attorney, who committed the negligence, rather than on the plaintiff in these cases?
I don't believe shifting the burden of proof to the defendant resolves the problem that the plaintiffs raised, having the burden of proof on them, that being, geez, it's very difficult to prove what would have happened in a mechanics lien foreclosure. It's difficult to find out what the equity was, if any. It's difficult to find out what the tiers, tier one being labor, and tier two, actually there's three, but in a reality there's two tiers. And would there have been any trickle down to the people in the second tier? If the defendant has to come up with this documentation, which they say is very difficult, the trial court said it's difficult, only in the context of it may take a lot of work. But it still does not absolve the plaintiff of having to come up with that same information. If the defendant comes up and shows that we go through the mechanics lien process and here's the equity and when it trickles down, you in tier two are going to get nothing, to controvert that, the plaintiff has to come up with their own set of evidence, which they say is difficult, if not impossible, to find out. But I don't think, I mean, that was their argument. It's hard to come up with that, and this is why the burden should be shifted to the defendant. That was their argument, and that was pointed out in the trial court's written order, where they argued about that, and the trial court said, geez, it's not that difficult. But even if we shift the burden, it doesn't absolve that problem that the plaintiff is trying to get out from under. And so I don't think it's a fairness issue that they're arguing.
But counsel, here there's no evidence, is there, on the value? There's no evidence on other liens or priorities. There's no evidence at all. Is that right?
There was no evidence presented.
So the question then is, when there's no evidence, whose problem is that? Is it yours or is it the plaintiff's? And I think the question we're trying to figure out is, why shouldn't it be on the defendant, the person who caused the problem in the first place?
Because the plaintiff is the one that in any tort action or like that, it's always the defendant, even in an automobile wreck, so to speak, that caused the problem. The defendant ran the red light, the defendant was speeding, so the defendant is always the one that caused the problem. The issue is not who caused the problem. The issue is may not even be whether there are damages. The issue is always, as the trial court said, the realistic value of those damages. In this case, the court was talking about what was the realistic value, if any, of the lien. And is it, do I have to come forward as a defendant in any case and try to prove a negative?
Do you agree that the plaintiff was injured?
The plaintiff did not receive payment from the people with whom the plaintiff contracted. And to that extent, yes, there was some injury.
It's approximately caused by your negligence.
Not with regard to the exact amount, because I did obtain judgments. Though.
Oh, so you're saying there, but what I'm trying to highlight, was there some amount that you agree, we understand nobody can set a definite amount, but are you agreeing that there is some amount that he did sustain injury, or the plaintiffs, excuse me, did sustain injury on?
I would not agree to that with regard to the mechanics lien foreclosure.
Because that's what I'm talking about.
No, I would not agree that there was some, because until we have all that information, we don't know whether there was any. We don't know whether there's any value.
Well, we know that the mechanics liens are in first place, aren't they, according to the system you talk about? Mechanics liens come first, right?
Yes.
Okay. So just taking Cottonwood One, the lien was $104,000. Are you telling us there was no evidence of what the value of that project was, that some of that $104,000 would have been paid? Or are you saying there were lots of other liens besides your client's liens that would have claimed against the value of Cottonwood One?
With regard to Cottonwood One, there was no evidence presented to trial by either party as to whether there was any equity, any value in the property.
When you filed the lien, didn't you investigate whether the lien would be collectible if you foreclosed on it? Weren't there some files in your, some documents in your file that show there's some value in Cottonwood One?
I was not the original the filer of that lien. That lien had already been filed, but you file the lien before you even find out there's any value, because you have time frames that you have to protect. And so you file that lien. Now, do we go forward with prosecuting the foreclosure on? And that's where you come into the effect of, okay, now we have to determine what, if anything, the claimant is going to get if we go through the foreclosure action. And this is the thing that the court awarded the $35,000 against me for, that purportedly I should have advised the plaintiff earlier on that there was no value in these and there was no sense in spending the money.
Is that what the record showed, that there was no value in all five of these projects and there was no
point? The record shows that there was no evidence of any value with regard to the mechanics lien presented by either party. The trial court reiterates that over and over again in its written order, that there was no evidence. And from which it can conclude, I think that's the way, that there's been no evidence presented from which the trial court can conclude, was there any damages, and if so, how much, with regard to the mechanics lien.
Is there evidence in your files that indicated there would have been no point in going forward with these mechanic liens because there was no equity in these buildings? Was that a decision, the conscious decision you had made in these cases?
There was evidence in my file to this effect, at least with regard to Cottonwood, and there was another overriding issue with regard to the Cottonwood before I got into the case, that there was a settlement agreement reached and a lien was dismissed by the plaintiff with respect to that settlement agreement, and then the settlement agreement did not come to fruition, and so there was an issue there. Was the second lien that was filed valid at all, since the first one had been dismissed pursuant to a settlement? Do we have a settlement? Do you have a lawsuit on the settlement because the lien was dismissed and that's all you've got? Or do you still have a right to go back and do the lien since you've already dismissed it and it became part of that settlement agreement?
But on the other cases, had you analyzed whether it was worth going forward with the lien foreclosure? Had you analyzed and decided there's no equity, I'm not going to proceed? Were there records in your file that
indicated? At some point, I analyzed it, but during this period of time, I was very, very ill, and I repeatedly told the plaintiff that I was ill and I was having difficulty keeping up with this, and he should seek another counsel. So to a certain extent on Cottonwood, there was these other lines. One of the other ones, I don't recall right now. I see my time is up, but I'll
ask you just one very quick question about the discovery. The plaintiffs contend that you never supplemented responses to 14 interrogatories you were ordered to respond to by an order on, to supplement, excuse me. You never supplemented responses to 14 interrogatories. You were ordered to supplement in November of 2010. Is that correct?
I provided two bank, what do you call it, bank
boxes,
source boxes of all my documents on the cases to plaintiff's counsel, not this counsel, but the other counsel. And I told him at the time, I have, because they wanted it like yesterday. I said, I haven't had time to make copies of anything, so this is everything I've got. They then copied those files, resorted them into whatever that was for them, and told me to, and there was no index for them, and told me to come up to their office and go through all these files and find the documents that I need. When it finally came down, the counsel came down, and there were, in fact, eight documents. And he knew what the eight documents were. He provided me those eight documents, but prior to me even having those eight, or from the time I got those eight documents, before I even had a chance to use them to respond, the plaintiff had filed the motion to compel, and the sanctions had already been issued. But
you did not have an opportunity. You're saying you didn't have an opportunity to respond.
So, I did not have an opportunity,
and therefore you did not.
After they gave me the documents that they said were relevant to the questions, I didn't have an opportunity.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Would you add one more minute to appellant's time, because we did let Mr. Whaley go over? If you need to use it, don't feel compelled.
Well, I'll wait till the clock shows the time.
But, sir.
On the issue of whether Mr. Whaley complied with the court's discovery order, there's a rather long and tortured history of how Ogborn, Summerlin, and Ogborn came to be in possession of those files, the efforts that were made to get those files to Mr. Whaley, and Mr. Whaley's opportunities to review those files and supplement his answers. It's set forth in the briefs, but there were a number of opportunities presented to him in which to arrange to come into possession of the documents and review them. It wasn't, and in fact, we requested extensions of time on our reply on that motion to compel for a number of weeks to provide additional time for him to review the documents and supplement his answers. So under these circumstances, the trial court's ruling, I think, is proper.
Court ordered fees as a sanction?
Yes.
And is that amount somewhere revealed in the judgment in this case? I don't know that I saw it.
It was not revealed in the judgment. It was revealed in a separate order on the motion to compel, and it's in the area of $3,500. I don't have the exact amount in front of me. But turning to the, in my mind, the bigger issue here, in personal injury cases in this state, we will let juries award damages for future medical care. Now, we don't require a plaintiff to prove that they're actually going to have that surgery, that they'll actually be able to afford that surgery after attorney's fees and costs and health insurance subrogation work their way out. But we do allow a presentation of an estimate, a projection, a statement of this is what it's going to cost. And in the same way, in legal malpractice cases, on the defense side, where you're alleging that a defense attorney was negligent and allowed a judgment to enter against you, the amount of the judgment is the presumed amount of your damages, not what you could pay, but the amount of the judgment that enters into in against you. It is only in the situation where you have a plaintiff who alleges malpractice that we impose this additional burden of collectability. And as to why there was no evidence regarding collectability at trial, if, as we submit, the issue is an affirmative defense and must be raised by affirmative pleading, Mr. Whaley did not allege a lack of collectability in his complaint. So plaintiffs were not on notice that this would be an issue. So no expert witnesses were retained to address that issue. And so as a result, there's no evidence regarding it at trial.
Statement in the record either by Mr. Whaley or somewhere, that the judge said, my problem with your case, I'm paraphrasing, is that I don't know what the value of these projects were at the time. I don't know what the equity was. I don't know what the other liens were. He gave you a heads up on that, didn't he, the judge?
Right. At the end of the first day of trial, the judge did give a heads up on that. However, at that time, there was no opportunity to retain an expert to perform the kind of economic analysis. In one of these lien cases, the time between when the lien entered and when the foreclosure should have occurred was over 5 years. In a five-year period, there's a tremendous amount of volatility that could occur in real estate values and equity that would require the plaintiffs to speculate as to the date on which a foreclosure sale would occur, and absent negligence, and what would be recovered. Under that situation where the evidence isn't available due to the negligence of an attorney, it is unfair to put the burden of proving collectability on the injured party.
Counsel, thank you. Thanks to both counsel for your arguments. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. And